The first time I'm called a terrorist is definitely somewhere in 2015 or 2016. I want to say it was before the Dallas shootings that there were mumbling of us being terrorists, Black Lives Matter, both the leadership but also the organization being a terrorist organization. But it was definitely the Dallas shootings, in which not just right-wing pundits, but elected officials and appointed officials were calling us terrorists. And I think it was a moment where I saw my face and folks who I love faces and the headlines of Bill O'Reilly and the headlines of Breitbart News. Yes, I think that was the first time.
You mentioned Texas. And specifically, you're talking about Micah Johnson, who at a Black Lives Matter protest ended up killing five police officers, who then responded by sending a robot to blow him up. Mm-hmm. When you woke up that morning and that was on the news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had just had my child just a few months before. I think I was 3 or 4 months out, and I remember first, before I got the news, because I was trying to stay away from the news and social media. I was supposed to be on maternity leave. I got a bunch of text messages, and they were like, did you see what happened in Dallas? Like, we have to get an emergency phone call. And as I looked, for folks of color, the first question we always ask about a shooter is, what race is he? Because it will determine the outcome of what happens to that person, but also what happens to us. And so the moment they said the shooter was Black, I was like, okay, like they're about to go after us. And that's exactly what happened. And we spent the next 48 hours to 72 hours trying to navigate how to have a conversation about the state's need to blame any Black person's behavior, especially if it was against law enforcement, on Black Lives Matter.
And there's this thing that happens, we joke about it though, in less serious situations, right? That when something happens, like if you're Black, you're praying, or brown, you're praying, right? Mm-hmm. And praying that it's somebody else. Mm-hmm. But then there's this dynamic that happens with people of color, within certain pockets of people of color. But then this group trots themselves out and apologizes, yeah, right, for whatever that person has done on behalf of the race of people. Mm-hmm. But when Dylann Roof, mm-hmm, right, murdered those folks, you never see white people trot people out and apologize for the brutality,
totally,
that they exercise on other people.
Yes. You are right, Kat. I think, it was such an interesting moment. And for us, if the audience remembers, this was like the height of a resurgence of protesting because Philando and because Alton Sterling had just been murdered. And so the Dallas protests were for Philando and Alton Sterling. And the moment those officers were killed, it took a sharp left turn. And I think the work of BLM in that moment was to keep the momentum for our movement. And I think it was really important that we were able to say, this is our focus. Our folks are dying. We have to continue to pay attention to that. It's a tricky dynamic, I think, when you're constantly being blamed for harms against other people. And it's easy to fall into the trap of apologizing. And I think part of the work that we have to do is show up for what we know is true, which is Black folks are dying at the hands of law enforcement every single day. And just last year, You know, 1,000 people died at the hands of the police, almost doubled from the year before. And today, 83 people, but month hasn't even ended yet, have been killed by law enforcement. We have to continue to have that conversation, even when it's in the spotlight and even when it's not.
Does that conversation shift or evolve when we are now in a dynamic of the Black Identity Extremist Report? Right, so for folks who don't know, but I imagine this is a room full of folks who do know, right, the FBI released a report called Black Identity Extremist, specifically about Black people that are doing work. And allegedly, or perceive that there is danger to their lives by law enforcement. The whole report is filled with allegedly, perceived, perhaps, right? No concrete admission, of course, that there's a war on Black life. Does the conversation shift at all?
It does. I mean, I want to just say a few things about that. Number one is that the Black Identity Extremist label is made up by the FBI. It didn't exist before the FBI created it. So that should make everybody feel mad suspect. We're not out here with like Black Identity Extremist hats and pens and t-shirts.
I'm about to get a shirt though.
I know, I've seen the pens. I've seen the pens. But that happened after the FBI created it. And I just think that's important, right? They created a whole identity for Black activists and Black activism. And two, that there's always been a long history of Black people who have fought for our freedom that have been labeled as terrorists, who have labeled as counterinsurgents, have been labeled as people who are trying to, well, we are trying to do that, so I'm not gonna say that. But have been labeled. And I think with this Black Identity Extremist label, we should see it in its historical context. And I'm curious about this moment because what we didn't have in the height of COINTELPRO is elected officials challenging the CIA publicly. What we do have in this moment is some elected officials, specifically Congresswoman Karen Bass, who has taken it the charge to hold Attorney General Jeff Sessions accountable, the FBI director, and really take them to task about this identity. And I think that's actually really important. And I think that's really necessary to have that conversation.
Trump. I could have saved him for last. but because I think this idea of Black identity extremists in particular, within the age of Trump and the war on dissent that he's waging, right? How does our organizing shift? Does it shift?
Yes, it does, and no, it doesn't. I think what's important is for us to understand that there's a long haul fight. And this particular moment, while we have to be responsive, we also can't get too wrapped up in reaction. I think what's been brilliant about the last 4.5 years is that we haven't gone anywhere. And the work has been ever more clear. I think the other piece is sometimes we get really caught up in sort of the national landscape when there's so much local work to be doing, when there's such a rich local fight. And in my opinion, and what we've seen historically, is the local really impacts the national. And if we can stay on the ground locally, if we could do that work, we could change the face of this country. We can look at... we can look at decriminalization, we can look at gay marriage, right? State by state, city by city, county by county, and eventually it spreads like wildfire across the country. So, my advice to organizers is always try to stay as local focused as possible with the clarity of a national and global lens.
Under the Obama administration, we saw a lot of reforms take place. We saw the Blue Ribbon Commission being formed. We saw body cameras. We saw the co-optation of the term community policing. We saw people talking about diversity in police departments. Can policing, from your perspective, be reformed?
No.
Why not?
Following your lead, facilitator. So yeah, flat out no. And I'm an abolitionist, a staunch abolitionist.
What does that mean for you?
I was just gonna give that definition. we're like Zoom right now. So abolition is not just the getting rid of something. It's also the imagining of something else, the building of something else. And so abolition has a long history in this country. The abolition of slavery. Slavery was never really abolished. We could talk about the 13th Amendment. Policing the court systems, jails and prisons, surveillance, is all in the prison police apparatus. And I believe that that should no longer exist. I think if we have policing, prisons, court, surveillance, in any form or fashion, Black people will always be suffering from it. We will always be bearing the brunt of those agencies. And so the work, I believe, is to abolish and abolish these systems. And then the other part of the work is to build institutions that are really the foundation around transformative justice, community accountability, and a deep desire for Black folks to have our dignity. And to be cared for in the ways that we deserve to be cared for. So, you know, this time especially, I think we should be calling for abolition. Under 45, it's easy because so much of what he's doing is egregious for us to sort of just to be like, all right, if we just get this, right, if we just get these small reforms, it's easy to sort of feel the hole of grief that we feel collectively because of this regime. But I think in these moments, when it's heightened, right, that we should be calling for abolition, that we should be naming it, we should feel unapologetic in naming it, and we should be creating our local movements to mirror what abolition could look like locally. Part of what that looks like, I think, is requesting and demanding that we divest from law enforcement. I know that APTP and many Bay Area groups have made a call for divestment from Oakland OPD. I know that in Los Angeles we've made a call to divest from LAPD. And what we've seen is that in all of the social service budgets, and it's a tragedy that law enforcement is called a social service, but in all the social service budgets, law enforcement is the budget that's always increased. It's always given the most money, it's the most resourced. And everything else, access to employment, access to healthy food, access to adequate public education, is divested from. And so we need to flip that. And we have to be courageous enough to call for that. And our elected officials, who are often backing law enforcement, have to show up and say, okay, we cannot allow this to happen anymore.
But Patrice, what about crime?
Oh, so-called crime. Yeah, let's talk about it. I think there's different kinds of conversations we can have about harm and violence. I don't use the word crime. I know you don't either. You're just being a good questioner.
I was
right
being
now.
A character.
I think we should always be talking about harm and violence and the ways in which we respond to it. I think the best organizers are not just talking about abolition without talking about accountability and community accountability. And some of the best work that I've seen it happening around this country, I've seen it happening in other places. Most of the communities that are marginalized don't actually call the police. I wasn't raised calling the police. In fact, in the book, I actually name a moment where I felt like I had to call the police. I did. They came, and then I asked them to leave. And I knew from that moment that, this calling the police actually isn't safe. And so we have to, it's imperative that we figure out other ways that we respond to harm and violence in our communities. And I could spend a bit of time on that, but I want to stop there.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm going to unravel that just a little bit further. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I really, that really sat with me in the book as someone who comes from a family that was riddled with addiction, mm-hmm. Is your analysis around addiction and accountability. So there's the 12-step program, mm-hmm. right, which centers on personal accountability. Mm-hmm. But you have a larger frame that's sort of rooted in the conditions of community that I would love for you to expand upon.
Yeah, and I use the phrase, it's really the issue I have with personal responsibility is it makes it seem like our actions are in a vacuum. And so I think there's a difference between personal responsibility, which I disagree with that term, and personal accountability. I think we should all be accountable for actions or behavior, but being responsible is different, is a different thing. And I think part of the work of looking at systems, especially a system that literally brought stolen people, brought them here to work on land, build up a place, and then didn't have a long-term plan for us. There was no long-term plan for Black people. And as we fought for our freedom, like we've been doing for 500 years, that has been grueling, it's been gruesome, it's been deeply traumatic. And so it is a human's natural response to cope with trauma. And part of coping with trauma is sometimes, or often, using substances. So that's one way to think about it. But there's another statistic that I think is very helpful, which is 80 to 90% of the people who use drugs don't ever become addicted to them. So then where did we come up with the idea that people, the moment you take a hit of something, you're gonna become addicted? That is rhetoric from the war on drugs. That's a rhetoric that was created to demonize mostly Black people. That was a rhetoric that was created to further this idea that Black people didn't know how to take care of ourselves, didn't know how to manage ourselves. And it was an idea that furthered the criminalization of Black people, right? We become addicted, we become violent, out of control, you have to lock them up, you have to put them away. And so I really challenge the language around addiction. I try not to use that unless that's really true for somebody. And I really try to problematize, well, what's really going on? Is the drug use the problem, or is it the system that created the conditions for someone to use drugs the problem?